From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, behavioral economics pioneer Richard Thaler wins the Nobel Prize.
I knew it could happen. You never count on anything, and you certainly never know when it might happen.
We'll talk about why Thaler's insight that humans are predictably irrational has transformed economics. Also today, pushback against the conspiracy of silence that surrounded Harvey Weinstein.
I'm telling you that Harvey has authorized me to be very forthright because he is ashamed of his behavior.
Oh. Plus, the science of freshly baked bread. Have you ever wondered,
why does it smell so damn good to us?
Answer, and how do I put this, microbiotic flatulence.
Well, yeast farts are what make bread rise.
Yeah.
Why not have another little side benefit?
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with that phone call that every academic dreams of getting someday.
Well, my cell phone rang at 4 in the morning, and it said Sweden on the phone, so I had a pretty good idea what that might be.
Indeed, it was the Nobel Committee, and they were calling University of Chicago professor Richard Thaler to inform him that he'd been awarded the 2017 Nobel Prize in Economics. Thaler is a pioneer in behavioral economics, a powerfully influential field that marries psychology and economics to produce better models of human decision-making. And today, Thaler said the basic premise of his work is, quote, in order to do good economics, you have to keep in mind that people are human. Well, joining us now is someone who knows Richard Thaler very well, Cass Sunstein. He's professor at Harvard Law School and a close friend of Thaler's. He co-authored a book with Richard Thaler called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. Professor Sunstein, welcome back to Radio Boston.
I'm great to be here. Thank you so much.
So first of all, have you been able to speak with Richard Thaler today?
I have indeed. I spoke to him around 7 in the morning, our time, 6 in the morning his time, and he sounded wide awake.
Wide awake and thrilled that his work has been honored in this way. I mean, so what was your reaction that he'd been awarded the Nobel Prize?
Completely thrilled. So he's as influential an economist as there is on the face of the earth, and he's not only altered how people do economics and think about economic theory, he's also had a great impact on what both the private and public sectors are doing. So to see recognition for someone who's a great guy but also made the world better, that's pretty good.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about behavioral economics today, we talk about it as, you know, somewhat a matter of fact, that of course it makes sense that this idea that we have to consider human beings as not totally rational actors should play a role in how we think about economics. But obviously it wasn't always thus. So can you take us back to the time where you were first introduced to the notion and what difference it made to you?
Yeah. So in the 1980s, in economics and basically law and political science, lots of fields, the idea is people are rational, meaning that if people smoke, it's because they enjoy it and they've calculated the benefits of smoking and they outweigh the costs. Or if people invest in one stock or another, that's kind of what they want to do. Or if people take a job, maybe there are big risks associated with it, but they're making rational choices. And this is actually very productive, and people who have had ideas like this have won their own Nobel Prizes, and those are well-deserved. But there are a lot of skeptics out there saying, come on, we know people who made crazy investments and who are addicted to smoking and who've taken jobs because they haven't really thought much about the alternatives or about the risks, let's say, associated with the job they took. And that kind of, let's call it clueless skepticism, was very much in the air. What Thaler did more than anyone, really, was to say, look, people are not fully rational, and here's exactly how.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go through about 5 different ways early in his career, and by now there are about, you know, 18 different ways, and each is very specific and empirically demonstrated, and a lot of them you wouldn't just intuit. You could be skeptical about the economic theory, but what the alternative was, it's, you can't develop that from the seat of the pants, and Thaler really developed the alternative.
Yeah. So describe to us some of the things that he elucidated here. I mean, I was reading a little earlier today about something that Professor Thaler called the endowment effect.
Yeah, okay, we'll do a little endowment effect experiment on this call. Okay, suppose you're holding a lottery ticket and it has a certain number. Then someone goes up to you and says, I'll buy it from you for $8 or $12 or $14. Would you sell? If you're like most people, you'd be kind of reluctant to sell, thinking, this is my lottery ticket. I might get a big payoff here. Now take it another way. Suppose someone comes up to you and says, I have a lottery ticket. You want to buy it? For $10, $12, $14, you might well say, that's crazy. I don't want to buy a lottery ticket. So the endowment effect means if you have something, chances are you're going to hold on to it a little like a tiger, and you're going to demand more to give it up than you would be willing to pay to get it in the first place. And whether we're talking about household goods or sweaters or jobs or spouses, the endowment effect is really important. And you can't understand kind of social and economic life without seeing that people's attachment to the things they now have way outruns how much they'd be willing to pay to get exactly those things if they didn't have them. And the endowment effect is actually instantaneous, and it helps explain some good marketing strategies, which make it seem as if you kind of already have this thing. Do you want to give it up?
Mm-hmm.
No. And it also helps explain some things that the government has done, which have paid attention to this aspect of the human mind.
Yeah. And so this is a perfect example of how powerful this notion of behavioral economics is, right? Because it's one way to understand more in depth why, I don't know, conventional models of markets don't always play out as one, you know, as algorithms or equations would predict them to play out in real life, right? When we have actual humans in those markets. And secondly, as you were pointing out, it helps sort of potentially guide policy. Now, we've seen some major changes that have come through through the research that Professor Thaler and others have done. I mean, for example, now there are companies, I believe, who automatically enroll people into retirement savings plans, and you have to opt out instead of opt in.
Completely. So we have a problem in the United States, and many countries have this problem, which is that people don't save enough for retirement. And one reason is they don't bother to get around to enrolling in plans from which they benefit. And if you just switch the rule from do you want to opt in to do you want to opt out, you can have a huge increase in participation rates. And actually, we've observed that in the United States, where automatic enrollment, which completely preserves freedom, if you don't want to be in the plan, you can get out, but automatic enrollment boosts retirement participation rates massively. And all over the United States, employers are doing this, and it's a policy tool that has a very big impact on people's future that doesn't cost the taxpayers a nickel.
Yeah. So to get back to Professor Thaler specifically, I love the fact that he's at the University of Chicago, right? Because that's like the bastion of uber rationalistic, you know, economic thought for I don't know, generations. And in fact, he commented on that he said that he knew it would be kind of a fight to introduce his ideas to his fellow faculty members there.
Yeah, I remember a workshop where he and I presented one of our early papers on what we're now talking about, how people depart from rationality and the implications of that for law and policy. And we gave it in front of the kind of true believers in people are rational. And it was like a war. I mean, faculty discussions are sometimes heated. This was, no one who has been at that workshop will ever forget it. People remember it decades later. And the degree of anger at Thaler and me in the room was really, really high. And Thaler, to his great credit, being attacked, you know, being completely unscientific and foolish and, you know, basically a hopeless case, he was funny and very cool. Afterwards, he wasn't a happy camper, but it shows you that, you know, the stakes are pretty high. And if you're thinking about environmental policy or what to do about smoking or what to do about opioid addiction or what to do about climate change, Thaler's work opens up a whole host of tools.
Yeah.
And it can get, pretty heated, whether the tool is a form of manipulation or whether it's a good idea.
Right. So let me ask you about that, because, I mean, there's the pushback that he received from classical economists, but also I think there's some pushback from folks who see the use of behavioral economics in policymaking as potentially paternalistic or manipulative, to use your word.
Well, I worked in the White House for 4 years under President Obama, and the range of things we did in the policy domain is very large, but a number of things we did were informed by Thaler's work, and as I think about it, not one of them was politically controversial. So when you buy a car, this year you'll see a fuel economy label, which is telling you about the money you'll spend with a fuel-efficient or non-fuel-efficient car. Gives you a bunch of simple information about things most consumers care about, and that is definitely informed by Thaler's work. One thing we did was to work on automatically enrolling kids in free lunch and breakfast plans to which they are entitled if they're poor, and this was a way of saying, if your parents don't sign you up because they're scared of the letter they received or because the letter's too complicated or because they're too busy or whatever, still you're in the program and you get the meals to which you're entitled. And that automatic enrollment plan was very welcomed by people on Republican and Democratic sides. Yeah. So I could list, easily 60 initiatives that are making a real impact on the lives of many millions of people. And it's hard to think of any one that was really politically divisive. So there's kind of noise among some talk show hosts about how nudges or uses of behavioral economics are one step away from George Orwell and communism. But the irony is that these things are like a GPS device. They tell you where to go if you want to get there, but if you don't like what the GPS is saying, you don't like the default rule, you don't like the reminder, you don't like the information, you want a gas-guzzling car, you're perfectly entitled to go in the direction you want.
Right.
But some of these initiatives are saving lives and others are saving a lot of money, and they're really not on the view screen of a political party that is, that's agitated about something.
So last question for you, Professor Sunstein. Today, Professor Thaler talked about how there's something of a generational divide, and we touched on it earlier. He says that, most economists under the age of 40 are fully on board with the behavioral economics framework, perhaps not so true amongst older folks. But then he was also saying that he thinks that eventually all economics will be as behavioral as the topic requires. Do you think that's true, that it's inevitable?
No question. And the real excitement, I think, not comes from the triumph of behavioral economics, but from the use of behavioral economics to help confront policy problems that we face, like over 40,000 people died on the highways in 2016. What are we going to do about that? We have a problem of, persistent poverty in the United States. How can we help? So as a problem-solving tool, we're going to see immense creativity. And I think that's where both the action and theory and practice is going to be in the future.
Yeah. And Professor Thaler absolutely demonstrated what I believe is a pretty good sense of humor today when he was asked how he's going to spend the money that comes along with the Nobel Prize. And he said, I will try to spend it as irrationally as possible.
Yeah, I'm going to help him not to. That.
Well, Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School and a good friend of Richard Thaler. Richard Thaler was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics today. They co-wrote the book Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. Thanks so much, Professor Sunstein.
All thanks to you.
Well, let's switch gears here pretty dramatically. More fallout against Harvey Weinstein today as Hollywood heavyweights come out against the 6-time Oscar-winning producer. They are, of course, reacting to last week's searing New York Times story that Weinstein allegedly sexually harassed women for years and, for years, kept it all quiet through at least 8 legal settlements. Meryl Streep today called his behavior, quote, disgraceful. Filmmaker Kevin Smith tweeted that Weinstein financed the first 14 years of my career, and now I know while I was profiting, others were in terrible pain. It makes me feel ashamed. Glenn Close said in a statement, yes, for many years I have been aware of the vague rumors that Harvey Weinstein had a pattern of behaving inappropriately around women. But now that the rumors are being substantiated, I feel angry and darkly sad. Close also added that she decried the conspiracy of silence around Weinstein's actions. And we should note that last night, Weinstein was fired by the board of the Weinstein Company, the company he helped co-found. Well, joining us now with her reaction is Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge, a retired federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
Okay. What do you think?
Where do I begin? On the one hand, you can say, as many are saying, that this sort of suggests that things are changing, that someone as powerful as he can be felled by these accusations along the lines of Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes. There's another side to that that is these accusations have been going on for the longest time. I was a young lawyer at the time of the Anita Hill accusations against Clarence Thomas that was supposed to effect change, suggest that sexual harassment was something that women could now say out loud and take action against. So, I mean, I'm sort of saddened that this is considered to be a major development. For me, it looks like same old, same old.
I mean, I have to agree. During the presidential election, there was a lot of talk about sexual harassment vis-a-vis the Access Hollywood tape and now President Donald Trump. And here we have Harvey Weinstein. I mean, we'll talk about how Democrats have reacted in a second here. But the only conclusion I come to is that, A, terrible behavior knows no party, and B, really, how is it that so little has changed for so long? I mean,
well, there's a lot in that question. I mean, one is the Access Hollywood issue is very interesting. That reflects a man who is doing and saying what he's doing, not because he is sexually needy, but because he can. In other words, it's the notion of you have the ability, you have access because you are a powerful man. And one gets the sense that Weinstein is the same kind of person.
Identical. I mean, right. From the New York Times reporting, he was specifically targeting young women who were, just entering the entertainment
because
industry.
He could.
Yeah.
I mean, that was so it's interesting. That sort of was a way of distinguishing Meryl Streep, who said it didn't happen to me and I didn't know about it. And Glenn Close, who said I heard about it vaguely. So you do it when you can, it seems to me. The other thing is that the structure of enforcement, which we've seen here, which is women sue and then there are confidential settlements. And the premise of that was that you get money and in exchange what you're bargaining for is silence. You thought that it would be effect deterrence because companies wouldn't, over time would say, I don't want to, this man is a liability because I have to keep on paying out because of his sexual harassment. But when you get to someone as powerful as Weinstein, the money is easy.
Right. So talk more about that because, as Glenn Close wrote in her statement that she feels sickened by the conspiracy of silence that surrounded Weinstein. But I have never heard, perhaps by definition, but I've never heard of a settlement in a case like this that didn't include some kind of non-disclosure.
That is essentially when you have when a woman sues for sex discrimination or someone sues for race discrimination, all that you have is the possibility of a huge monetary settlement, but also the embarrassment that the case brings. And so when somebody says, I'm going to give you money in exchange for your silence about that, that's par for the course. That was the reason for the Catholic Church's sexual assault crisis remaining confidential for the longest time. It really, we rely on litigation to affect social change, but this is the Achilles heel of litigation.
Right, because it further pushes things into the darkness.
Right, and as I said, I mean, part of it is that if I'm going to have to spend money because of this employee, maybe I will then monitor this employee. That would be the rationale. But when you start getting up to the levels that Weinstein is at, money was easy. Paying these women off were easy.
Yeah.
It was easy.
Weinstein said in a statement that he came of age in the 60s and 70s. Oh, look, you see your eye rolling. But I want to know what you think about this because, I mean, granted, on the one hand, he says mea culpa, but he's also seeming to insinuate that, it's okay because that's how, Mad Men? I mean, I don't know.
Mad Men was earlier, but I
understand
what he was talking about. I actually understand what he was talking about. He was saying that it was true that in the 60s and 70s, the rules changed. But the fact that the rules changed didn't mean that there were no rules. They were just different rules. It was not that it was no longer that, you were going to be monogamous or that you were going to be, that you were going to only have relations with the people that you were marrying. It was, things were certainly freed up, but there were still meaningful standards about what you do, and you don't exploit, and you don't push, and you don't pressure, and you don't, take away a woman's autonomy. In other words, the rules changed, but there were still rules of behavior which we all understood,
yeah.
And he apparently didn't.
Well, and also, he wasn't doing these things just in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
He was doing these things when the rules had substantially changed,
right.
And what he was doing was illegal.
Right. The other side of the coin, which no one has really focused on, is how did it happen that this could be a sudden explosion like this? In other words, the company had to have known about these settlements over time, had to have watched what happened to Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, and the notion that this could suddenly happen and they suddenly deal with it also says something about the conspiracy of silence. They would just as soon bury their head in the sand. I mean, I can't believe that the Board of Trustees didn't know about it. They were going to have to approve these settlements, and now they're all sorts of indignant. There's an institutional problem here that no one is coming to grips with.
I mean, the institutional problem being that perhaps his behavior is more of the norm than the exception.
Right. But again, it's not just what he did. It's also the notion that the company didn't know about it. One of the last cases I had before I went on the bench involved a young woman, Harvard law student, who went to work for an entertainment firm in L.A. The lawyer who she was working for used to ask her to deliver papers to his home. He'd open the door and he'd be in his underwear. And he wanted her to be a consort, essentially, to the big stars that he was bringing in. We mediated the case. We began to call other women who had interacted with him over a 10 or 15 year period. Literally, one woman picked up the phone and said, "Do you want to hear about the drugs or the sex?"
Ugh.
And it had been an open secret, very much like this.
But this seems to happen so frequently, right? Because this kind of behavior is serial behavior.
Right.
And then there's,
right.
I feel like every story has that moment where someone decided to reach out, and all of a sudden there's this entire network of women at lower levels who actually, perhaps for decades, had been talking to each other.
Right. But that's partly the enforcement structure, which enables confidential settlements, basically keeps this going on and on and on, particularly for men who can afford to pay the women off. In the local, the grocery store at the end of the block, it might be enough to dismiss someone. But for the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, it's really not, because the money was easy.
Yeah. There's so much to talk about this, what's encapsulated in the Harvey Weinstein story. But I have to ask you, what did you make when I was kind of blown away when I saw Lisa Bloom's name in the New York Times piece last week, because she's, of course, the daughter of
Gloria Allred.
Gloria Allred, feminist legal warrior, quite frankly. Now, Lisa Bloom was working or representing Weinstein until very recently. She's no longer representing him. But, what did you make of that?
Well, I mean, that's actually a complicated question. That's a complicated question. There certainly, it reminds me of a good friend of mine, Susan Estrich, who is a well-known feminist, was representing Roger Ailes. Those are not the decisions that I would have made. But the legal profession says that everybody deserves a defense.
Did you ever ask Susan why?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because I'm dying to know.
Well, she had a long-term relationship with him, not a sexual relationship. She had a long-term professional relationship and was loyal to him. There is something, let me say that again. There's something to the notion that lawyers, everyone deserves a defense. It works particularly on the criminal side because the idea is that an individual facing the government's power in particular needs a defense. On the civil side, when I was a young lawyer, I actually didn't abide by that rule, because I thought that in a civil case, I can and should pick and choose whom I decided to spend my resources on. She made a different choice.
Yeah. So one more thing I want to get your considered reaction on, because, the other thing about the Weinstein case, oh gosh, I'm going to try and get this in here in a minute. Is he, folks from the right are gleeful about the fact that Harvey Weinstein was a big Democratic donor, talked a progressive talk a lot, knew the Clintons, the Obamas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As of today, we can't find anything from Hillary Clinton that's speaking out against what Harvey Weinstein did. Isn't that a problem?
It is a problem. It surely is a problem.
I mean, this seems like a no-brainer to me.
Right. It surely is a problem. It does seem to me that this is something that really crosses over political lines. And if you're aghast at the behavior, you should be aghast at the behavior no matter what side you're on.
Well, we're aghast. Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and WBUR's legal analyst, thank you so much as always.
You're very welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I think I say my own name right. Well, how about this? Nathan Myhrvold is a scientist and a chef. And according to Myhrvold, this is one of life's greatest pleasures.
When hot bread comes out of the oven, it's just awesome. Yeah. It smells so damn good.
As I said, Myhrvold is both a chef and a scientist. He was former chief technology officer at Microsoft. So he's the kind of guy who, when confronted with the fragrant awesomeness of freshly baked bread, he's got questions. Lots of questions, such as,
why does it smell so damn good to us? That was one of the questions.
See, this is what Myhrvold does. He pursues the most scientifically detailed answers to the magic behind what happens in a kitchen. In 2011, Myhrvold did just that in the six-volume, 2,438-page Modernist Cuisine, a beautifully photographed and researched encyclopedia that answered every question from what's the physics of a poached egg to the chemistry of gelling. Well, now Nathan Myhrvold has taken that same scientific method to the world's oldest and most ubiquitous staple. So, back to that question. Why does freshly baked bread smell so damn good?
I can't quite figure it out, but I did figure out how it smells so good.
Tell me.
It has to do with volatile compounds that are created by the yeast.
Uh-huh. So the gases that the yeast are creating by eating the grains.
Yep.
Yeast farts is what makes bread taste so good, smell so good. Sorry, I have kids, and that's just like right where my mind went.
Well, yeast farts are what make bread rise.
Yeah.
So why not have another little side benefit?
Okay, so I apologize. I didn't really mean to take it down to the lowest common denominator because really, Nathan Myhrvold's latest book deserves much higher-minded praise. It's another multi-volume whopper called Modernist Bread, The Art and Science. And again, a couple of thousand pages of joyful investigation into everything you ever wanted to know about bread. So let's really get started now with the simplest of questions. When we say bread, what exactly do we mean?
For us, bread is microbially leavened. Mm-hmm. So that means muffins or cakes or other things that you leaven chemically with baking powder or baking soda aren't in the book, except for one, Irish soda bread. Irish soda bread is wanting to be a real bread. And so it's the exception that proves the rule.
Okay.
And then of the world's flatbreads, it turns out some flatbreads, Indian dosa, for example, is a sourdough. Lavash, believe it or not, is leavened.
It is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. My mom's dosa recipe is still one of my favorites. So I know that process very well.
So here's a trick to try then.
Okay.
Bake it in a waffle iron.
A waffle iron?
It works great.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Dosa in a waffle iron is awesome.
Oh, my God. Well, actually, I can see why, because you'd get the crispy exterior that you need for a good dosa, but then you would maintain the soft fluffiness as well.
And it holds more coconut chutney.
Okay. You might have just sold me with that. Actually, really might have. I'm going to have to give that a try. Okay, so 4 years. Take me through this process. I mean, what were some highlights of the 4 years of research that you did?
One thing we always do when we start a project, we get all the books that we possibly can. Mm-hmm. Of course, then you keep getting them as you do the project. But we take all the recipes and we enter them into a computer database. And the reason is we wanted to study what's the variation. Like when people say, oh, here's a recipe for a baguette. Well, how does it differ from other recipes for a baguette?
Yeah.
And I naively thought that because baking is reputed to be precise and exact and so forth, that we would find that all the baguette recipes clustered tightly together and all of the breads of other types would cluster closely together. Totally false. I think we have 120 baguette recipes. Most of the ingredients vary by a factor of at least two.
Hmm.
That's kind of crazy because you'd say, well, wait a minute. How could you have, you know, twice as much salt or twice as much yeast or twice as much water and still have it work? Part of the answer is that bread is really resilient. You can abuse it quite a bit, and it'll kind of still, you know, get made.
Tell us more. I mean, again, so many volumes here, but tell us more about the physics and chemistry of bread that you got a better understanding or a better appreciation for in writing the books.
Well, bread is a pretty amazing substance. Here's one of the cool physics aspects of bread. If you have a nice round loaf of bread, we've got a round loaf here in front of us, it'll take about 20 minutes to bake. If you had a piece of roast beef the same size, it would take hours to cook. How come? We did a bunch of experiments and we figured it out. Bread actually works like what an engineer would call a heat pipe. Mm. So it turns out that rather than in a roast or some other piece of solid food, it's conduction. And we know about conduction, right? If you hold a pan, the metal pan, and eventually your hand will get hot if the pan's over a stove because the metal conducts heat. But bread conducts faster than it should be possible.
Huh.
And the reason is that once the crust forms, when water boils inside the bread, it can't go out because the crust is already formed. So the steam pressure bursts bubbles, and it sends the steam burrowing into the center of the bread.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So for the same reason that a radiator radiates lots of heat, and you have steam pipes in a building here in New England to heat it up in a cold winter, effectively, the bread makes its own steam pipes by bursting a series of bubbles and penetrating all to the core.
Huh. Wow. So, and how were you able to determine that?
Well, we did a lot of experiments where we stuck thermocouples, temperature sensors, all throughout bread. We tried to figure out how it could possibly be going so fast, and then we finally realized it was a heat pipe.
Wow. So I have to ask you, Nathan, so you're you used to be chief strategist and CTO at Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
And so this is, we're veering far away from bread here for just a minute, but how did you get, were you always a chef, a baker? I mean, how did you get so fall in love with the idea of really delving into the science and technology of the food that we eat?
So when I was 9 years old, I discovered cookbooks in the local library, and I decided I was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner all by myself, and I did. And from that point onward, I was a very serious self-taught chef. Then at some point when I was working at Microsoft, I decided that I like cooking enough that I shouldn't be self-taught anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Bill Gates and I asked for a leave of absence to go to chef school in France, which Bill granted. It's the only time he's had that request, I think. And so I did go to chef school in France. Then after retiring from Microsoft, I spent more time cooking. And I had been aware that there was a whole set of modern cooks that were developing brand new techniques.
Yeah.
And I naively thought there should be some big book I could buy that would explain all of it. Only it turns out there was no big book, so I wind up having to write it.
Oh, we're getting away from bread here, but a couple more questions on this line. Because I think you're right. Those modern chefs creating this whole new way of cooking, they look like laboratory scientists actually sometimes with their white coats and their stainless steel and the foam and the vapors, for example. But, you know, why do you think it's important to bring that sort of same scientific attitude into the home kitchen?
Well, my first book came out. There was a reporter who asked exactly that. They said, why do you think you had to bring science into the kitchen?
Because cooking is science. That's my answer. But
well, no, I said, look, science was already there. It's taking ignorance of science out of the kitchen that we're doing. Yeah. And there are people who say, oh, you're spoiling it or you're destroying the soul of cooking. And I think that's just garbage. The thing that makes cooking wonderful is the way that flavors and textures can evoke thoughts and emotions and memories in us. It's an art.
Yeah.
And equipping an artist with the tools to understand how their art works is only good. In fact, the art I like to analogize cooking to is architecture. Most buildings on Earth are there to keep the weather out. They're not really great works of art or architecture, okay? But a great building can be a work of art and architecture. It can have soaring shapes and vistas and things that grab us emotionally. Well, in the same way, most food is fuel.
Yeah.
Okay? If you don't eat, pretty soon your tummy starts saying, wait a minute now. You get hungry. Most meals for most people, including me, are really there because you get hungry. You need them. But that doesn't mean that we can't harness the incredible relationship we have with food to do things that are magical, that delight us, that evoke memories of home or you know, comfort food is comforting. But food can be exciting and theatrical.
Yeah.
The high end of cooking has been about people delighting us that way. But regardless of whether you're at the high end or you're in the home, knowledge of how it works doesn't hurt you.
Yeah. You know, I always thought that we did ourselves a disservice however long ago when we as a culture tried to divorce science and art because, you know, in my mind, they are one and the same. So here's a couple of really basic questions. Do you have a favorite kind of bread?
Almost any kind of bread.
All of it.
Yeah.
All of the above. Okay. Is there a recipe that you go back to a lot?
Well, my single favorite recipe in the book is probably a chocolate cherry sourdough. That's really good. Yeah. But there's different breads that are great for different purposes. I love dosa, but I also love brioche. Yeah. Now, those are two pretty different things. Indian bread is interesting because it brings up a fascinating sort of schism in the world of bread bakers. People developed ovens for a very different purpose. It wasn't for bread. Ovens were developed for firing pottery.
Uh-huh.
Well, somebody then said, hey, we could actually make our bread in one. But there were two different inventors in two different parts of the world. And one guy says, hey, I know. Let's stick our bread to the ceiling of the oven. And the other guy says, oh, let's put it on the floor. And, of course, ceiling is what happens with naan.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in Europe and the Middle East, they put it on the floor. Once you start putting the bread on the ceiling, you will never have pizza.
True.
Stuff falls off. You also won't have a pan bread.
Yeah.
It turns out you can actually bake a medium sort of brioche in a tandoor. We tried. But at a certain butter content, it falls off. But but up to a certain butter content, it'll still stick to the roof, and you can make a brioche naan.
That's you can worlds are colliding in my head right now. Actually, I'm gonna have to try that because like a heavy butter naan sounds amazing to me.
It is, and it really is.
Well, I mean, look, you've got, what, five volumes of...
Five hardcover, one softcover.
Wow. In a stainless steel box.
Slipcover,
Slipcover. I mean, who are the books for? Because it's more than $600, right, for
$625 list price. Yeah. We don't control how it's discounted. My guess is most people will pay less. The books are for people who are passionate and curious about food. If you're not passionate about food, you're not going to spend that kind of money with,
anyway,
with a book. You're not even going to spend the amount of time it takes to flip through it, even if it was free. But you also have to be curious. Because lots of cookbooks will say, do this, do this, do this, and you'll get a result. And if all you care about is getting the result and you don't wonder why, well, just buy those other cookbooks and do the recipes, and it works super well. I mean, you don't even need a cookbook. You can go on the internet and find a zillion recipes. Mm-hmm. The point of modernist bread is to cover the history, the science, the technique, and then tons of recipes that we have slaved over and sort of distilled from all the world's baking traditions. And if you are curious, that's compelling. There's a widespread belief in publishing that for a book to be successful, you have to dumb it down. And I don't think that's true. I don't want it to be true. And, you know, for my previous books, we've sold almost 250,000 of them worldwide. So somebody thought it was a good idea. And, of course, with the Modernist Bread book, you might discover, hey, bread is a narrower topic.
Yeah.
I've got no idea how it will sell. But so far, it's doing well.
Well, hear, hear for not dumbing things down, quite frankly. You seem to have so much fun. In addition to the sort of investigative nature of the work you're doing and the creative nature, it just seems like so much fun. But I do wonder, have you come to the point where it's not possible for you to sit down at a meal anywhere and without thinking, like, how did they do this? How is it made? Like, just sort of deconstructing the processes around it?
I think that makes it better.
Okay.
I am not pro-ignorance. Sorry.
This is the man who's wearing the science doesn't care what you believe t-shirt.
Correct. Understanding how the process works does not lessen the impact. Okay, in the same way that if you go see some fantastic movie like Star Wars, at the back of your head, you know this isn't really happening a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And those really are special effects you're seeing. But the story is compelling and it grabs you. So I don't think that a knowledge that this is created by someone or even the techniques of how it's created lessens it.
No, it deepens our appreciation, right?
That's my view.
Well, Nathan Myhrvold's new book, or books, I should say, five-volume hardcover book is called Modernist Bread, The Art and Science. It's amazing, fantastic, and thank you so much for coming in and talking about it with us.
My pleasure.
And Modernist Bread is out next month. By the way, we've got a recipe for Nathan's favorite bread, that chocolate cherry sourdough that he talked about. It's at our website, radioboston.org. Back in about 90 seconds. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We want to take a moment now to remember Boston actor Thomas Dara. He died late last week after being diagnosed with cancer at the end of June. Dara was just 64 years old. Now, you may know the theater icon from his many faces on stage, as Mark Rothko at Speakeasy Stage Company, for example, or as the Jungle Book's Ka at Huntington Theater Company, or as Iago at the American Repertory Theater. Dara was also a founding member of the ART. He won the Elliot Norton Prize for Sustained Excellence in 1994. We spoke with him back in 2015 when Dara was starring in the play Casa Valentina at the Speakeasy Stage Company. The play, written by Harvey Fierstein, follows the true story of a group of men in the 1960s who gathered in the Catskills to dress up as women. And Thomas Dara told us about the play and his role in it.
Well, I played actually, I guess technically two roles. I'm George and Valentina. So George is the male version of this character, and Valentina is his feminine personality, his inner inner girl, I guess. And he is a married heterosexual man, married to a woman that he met when he brought his ratty wig in to be done in New York City, and she runs a wig shop, or ran a wig shop, and he wanted to create this resort in the Catskills for like-minded men to come and get away from the rigors of society and dress, cross-dress. And in those days, since 1962, it was called transvestitism. Mm-hmm. You know, it was there weren't any sort of other categorizations, and it was obviously very a marginalized group, and they prided themselves on the fact that they were heterosexual men. And this is one of the interesting elements of
yeah.
this play.
I mean, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, again, it's an extremely marginalized group that are fighting very hard for their place at the table. And I think that there's some surprising homophobia in the play. I think this is what takes a lot of people by surprise, because they sit around talking about becoming more legitimate. There's one of the characters in it is a character by the name of Charlotte, who's based on an historical figure whose name was Virginia Prince, who's sort of an activist and an organizer, and ran a magazine called the Transvestia. And she did speaking engagements and was very much into sort of trying to mainstream this idea of men following the pursuit of their inner femme personalities. So it's all very interesting how when they have this one sort of big summit meeting about not really unionizing but becoming registered with the United States government, they're very anti-gay,
right?
Very anti-homosexual.
You know, so we mentioned a little earlier that the play was written by Harvey Fierstein.
Yes.
And we actually have a little bit of tape from him explaining a little more of this exact pivotal moment in the play that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So here it is.
Great.
Homosexuality was the greatest danger to this community, that society would never, ever accept them as long as people thought they could be queer. They voted and made the organization heterosexual only. There's a line in the play where Charlotte, who owns the publishing company and everything, says, 50 years from now, when homosexuals are still the back alley vermin of society, we will be dressing and as normal as smoking cigarettes.
Isn't it so interesting that, I mean, we are 50 years from then, and that's not how it turned out at all.
Not at all.
How does staging the play now, I mean, here in Boston, how does it come across in Boston?
It's interesting. It's, I think, as I said, people are surprised because they think it's going to be a very conventional, sort of lighthearted look at men dressing as women in 1962 and lip-syncing to the McGuire sisters and having a great time, drinking too much and behaving in very silly ways. And all of a sudden, it takes a very dark turn. You know, the whole homophobia thing sneaks in, and the whole identity of, crisis identity. And every one of these men cross-dresses for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's so complicated. It's the most complicated thing ever. And I still think that people are having a hard time, even today in 2015, knowing how to ask questions, knowing how to approach people that they might know or acquaintances.
So you have to inhabit this complication as George and Valentina.
Yes, yes.
How do you do that? I mean, because both appear, I mean, they're the same person, but two different personas,
mm-hmm.
and both appear on stage.
Yes.
What's that like as an actor?
Well, first of all, it's fun. But secondly, I think in terms of the character, it's quite a crisis of conscience. I think he's looking for his or her authentic self, and I think that's part of the crisis. It always has been, I think, for especially people in the trans community, finding their real authentic self. And I think this is, before there was even vocabulary for that, this is in 1962, obviously. this was haunting these men for whatever reason it was. Some of them could live quite happily double lives, you know, with married with children, and their wives sort of looked the other way, and others had other deeper issues.
Yeah. Well, we've just got about a minute to go here, mm-hmm. and we could talk a lot about this play because it's just so fascinating.
Indeed.
But I did want to ask you one quick question before I ran out of time about director Scott Edmiston.
Edmiston, yes.
Excuse me. He's directed a ton of stuff in New England, from Nixon in China to Spring Awakening, Sunday in the Park with George. I'm just wondering mm-hmm. what it's like working with him.
Oh, he's a wonderful director and an excellent facilitator. I think of getting all the personalities in the room together and creating this wonderful ensemble. It was a wonderful room that he created, a space to go to work, to rehearse every day and to ask these questions.
That's actor Thomas Dara speaking to us about the play Casa Valentina. He spoke to us back in 2015. Dara was a founding member of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. He was diagnosed with cancer in June and died last Thursday. He was 64 years old. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.